it's not natural to stick a cow in a feedlot and stuff it full of red Skittles. Roxarsone, which was one of the major players in the drug, the drug industry. And I told them, I would like a quote for shipping to my U.S. address and, yada, yada. And they got back to me right away, both within 24 hours. It was no problem to ship it into the U.S. There's no, as far as I know, I didn't take it any farther because obviously I'm not buying arsenic for my chickens. But I was, surprised that nobody said, oh, well, we're not allowed to ship that into the U.S.
The Culinary Libertarian Podcast, episode 41.
Welcome to the Culinary Libertarian Podcast, where the philosophy is free, but the food is on you.
Hello, folks. Welcome back to the podcast. Dan Reed here, the Culinary Libertarian. Happy to have you here. Happy to be here. A few things. First, head over to my podcasts page, culinarylibertarian.com/podcasts, and there you can join my Eating Liberty Facebook group. You can also follow me on Twitter, Minds, Gab, and bitbacker.io, as well as subscribe to my YouTube channel. You can support the show with donations through Patreon, PayPal, and Bitcoin. You can also support the show with a mouse click and some kind words in the form of a 5-star rating and a positive review of the show on your favorite podcatcher. That helps move the show up in the rankings and lets more people find it. For your coffee or tea drinking needs, or whiskey, you can visit my Cranky Without Coffee Gear Bubble shop at culinarylibertarian.com/gearbubble. And also pick up a copy of my Muffins e-cookbook by giving me your email address. I'll send you a copy of the e-book, and you'll get a few emails from me every week or so. And you can find the links for the e-book and the Gear Bubble at the podcasts page, culinarylibertarian.com/podcasts. Regular listeners know I often talk about politics or homeschooling here. I am pleased to share with you a new affiliate, the McClanahan Academy. Brian McClanahan is the founder, and Brian is a PhD in history and also does have courses in the Liberty Classroom. McClanahan Academy is Brian's own course with classes on American history specifically and special focus on the Declaration of Independence, Alexander Hamilton and How He Screwed Up America, and Restoration and Reconstruction. McClanahan Academy is not the sanitized history you were taught in high school and most colleges. Brian's website reads, quote, "McClanahan Academy courses sandblast away the years of rust, corrosion, and brain rot produced by mainstream history curriculum. My courses challenge conventional wisdom and modern groupthink. They are for the strong-minded, curious student who wants a real history education untarnished by establishment academics." End quote. Click over to culinarylibertarian.com/academy to see the full selection of course titles. Brian has a real passion for history, and unlike my high school history classes, these will never be boring. culinarylibertarian.com/academy. My guest today is Jerrica Cadman, owner of Shady Grove Ranch in East Texas. She came to farming from a health crisis with her husband, Matt, which she's going to tell us about. On that journey, they discovered health comes from sustainable and natural farming practices. Jerrica has become active as an advocate for knowing what your food eats, and we'll discuss an issue about that also. A link to her farm's website and blog is at today's show notes page, culinarylibertarian.com/41. So, for the week of Secession Day, what is more in tune than a good rubbing of the FDA? Welcome, Jerrica. Thank you for joining me on the Culinary Libertarian Podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, it's my pleasure. So before we get into this, let's take a minute just to get a little bit of your background, how you came into farming, and what seems to me, I guess the way I would call it, is a little bit of farm activism, or at least advocacy for farming.
Sure. Well, I did not start out as a farmer. I really had no intention of being a farmer. My husband and I met when we were studying engineering in college, and it was my freshman year and his super senior year, so that was exciting. And anyway, we really just clicked and became very good friends, and he finally convinced me to start dating him, and then convinced me to marry him. So we were engaged, and I remember when I first met him, I just discovered this little oddity about him, that he was not able to eat any raw fruits or vegetables at all because he had some sort of disease. And neither of us knew very much about it. You know, he was in his early 20s at that time, and, you know, had to take these little brown pills, and that's just really all we knew. And so after we got engaged, he came down with some much worse symptoms, and started rapidly losing weight, was losing blood, and just became extremely weak and debilitated, and so ended up being hospitalized. And he had already been diagnosed with ulcerative colitis, but he didn't really understand what that meant. And he did not realize that this was a lifelong diagnosis, that, you know, he was going to have to be on drugs for the rest of his life. And most people with that disease end up having a total removal of the colon, and that's considered to be the cure of the disease. So anyway, so he was hospitalized. He stands about 6'5", and at his a little bit above his lowest weight ever recorded, because he kind of just didn't want to know how lightweight he was. But he got down to about 120 pounds before he stopped measuring. And we were just, you know, totally not expecting that debilitating experience at all. Like, it just totally blindsided us. And so, you know, we were kind of the, you know, subject to the mercy of the doctors, and did whatever they told us, and, you know, got on the steroids and the antibiotics and the gene therapy drugs, and, you know, just all this stuff. And he finally was released from the hospital about 12 days later. It was, you know, I won't say miraculous, but it was very, you know, we just had prayed a lot, and there was really no reason why they should be releasing him. And we just feel like the Lord delivered him from that situation for some reason. And so he got out of the hospital, slowly started recovering. They had told him, you know, you need to be on a low residue diet. You need to eat like white bread, processed foods, no whole grains, no vegetables. And so he was very meticulous about following the rules. He was, you know, he wouldn't let anybody touch his face. He was super paranoid about bacteria, because they had told him this was a bacterial infection. That's what caused it. Sure enough, like, he followed all the rules, you know, he was on like 20 pills a day. I mean, it was just crazy. Less than a year later, he had the exact same experience in spite of following all doctor's rules. Just uncontrollable, spiraling downward into weight loss, frequent bowel movements, loss of blood, loss of energy. He ended up going, you know, both times he had to have blood transfusions because his hemoglobin was down at like a 5 or a 6. And it was the same thing over again. Like, the only solution was steroids, antibiotics, super gene therapy drugs, which were like $1,800 a dose, you know, on autoimmune suppressants, that sort of thing. And, you know, it just didn't really work. They you know, presented this one drug that was like $1,800 per dose. And they were like, okay, well, this is kind of the last resort, but it always works. You know, there's just some risks, but it's, you know, it's really powerful, really good. And it didn't work. And they gave him another dose of it, and it still didn't work. And, you know, so we just were really shell-shocked, didn't know what to do. You know, we're just kind of at the mercy of the doctors telling us, you know, what we should do. And they told him he had a C. diff infection, which is a bacterial infection of the guts, a very severe one for people like him with compromised immune systems and damaged intestinal tracts. And anyway, so we had just... we were out of options. We were praying a lot, and we just feel like God intervened and allowed him to be released from the hospital in spite of, like, he was not feeling better. He was not doing better, but they let him go home for some reason. And, He started slowly recovering. He was following, you know, strictly following doctor's orders. Just to shorten the story. So, you know, he went home. He was taking like 20 pills a day. He was following doctor's orders. He was super careful about exposure to bacteria. You know, was constantly washing his hands, would not allow anyone to touch his face. He was following the low residue diet that was prescribed, which basically means no fiber, all processed foods, no whole grains, nothing like that. And it worried us because, you know, of course, we were concerned about just nutrition. But at the same time, you know, he certainly couldn't go back in the hospital like that. But in spite of the, you know, just his diligence to follow what he was told to do, he was hospitalized again with the same exact symptoms less than a year later. And it was shortly after we got married. So, you know, the second time we started to really question, why is this happening? They don't seem to have an explanation. You know, the only solution for them is for doctors is drugs and or surgery, which we just really didn't want to do. I mean, he was in his early 20s, you know, to lose your colon for the rest of your life and just all the implications there was terrifying. So we really began to question, you know, they told us, we specifically asked, is this a diet thing? Like, I mean, it's intestinal. Seems intuitive to think that it would be related to diet. And doctors said, no, it's just hereditary. It just happens to you. There's nothing you could have done to prevent it. You know, it's just something. And that didn't fit in our worldview. We just felt like, no, bodies aren't made to malfunction, especially not healthy. But he was very athletic, very fit, you know, a super healthy person. And it just didn't match up, you know, it just didn't make sense. So we started really researching and we ended up finding out about the Weston Price Foundation, which is a great group for teaching traditional diets, traditional eating, you know, getting away from processed food. And what did our ancestors eat and what did their health look like really? You know, everybody says, oh, well, people used to just die in their, you know, late 30s. And we've got such better health today. But, you know, if you really look at the evidence, that's not really true worldwide, you know, in all situations. So anyway, we were invited to a food conference that taught about how to eat, you know, real things like butter and bacon and raw milk and, you know, sourdough grain and, you know, that kind of thing. And so, you know, it kind of blew us away because it's like butter is so unhealthy. Why would you want to eat that? You know, but at the same time, they presented evidence that showed that butter from pasture raised animals hasn't been processed, hasn't been added, you know, all this stuff added to it, antibiotics fed to the cattle, so on and so forth. It's extremely nourishing and it's quite healing to the intestine and exactly what a person like Matt would need who had impaired digestion. An autoimmune disease, you know, his body was attacking itself and it totally made sense and it was exciting. And we were, just delighted to find out about this, you know, this alternative solution to his extreme health problems. And so we started, you know, looking for the sources of that kind of food and, you know, and it was out there, but this was back in like 2007 in East Texas, which is considered a food desert area. People, you know, it's fried chicken and donuts and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, so we found some farms, but they were like, here's one over here. It sells, you know, pasture-raised chicken, but it's 2 hours away from where we live. And here's one over here that sells pasture-raised eggs, but it's an hour from where we live south, you know, the other direction. And here's another one over here, that sells beef, but you got to buy a whole cow at a time. So if you don't have the freezer space, you're going to have to find a bunch of friends to go in with you and you know, and deal with this, you know, 500 pounds of meat or whatever. And so there were a lot of hurdles. We were very driven. We were willing to do whatever it took to get Matt healthy again. And, you know, but we've started thinking like, in fact, Matt started making preparations to go back to medical school. Now, again, he had already graduated in engineering. I was about to finish up my degree. And, you know, so he went to part-time work to start taking classes on the side to go to med school to try to research a cure for ulcerative colitis, the disease that he had. And meanwhile, we're just trying to figure out what is our life going to look like? What do we want to do? Yeah. So the, you know, Weston Price Foundation was presenting a very different view, you know, and it wasn't even so much, you know, don't eat, you know, the doctors were saying, well, they didn't really out and say you need to eat processed food, but they did say you need to eat no fiber and you need to eat, you know, low residue foods. And so that does translate into no fiber. Processed is perfectly fine. Don't eat raw vegetables. Don't eat, you know, don't eat fruit. You know, eat white bread, you know, that kind of thing. And so that does mean, you know, lots of canned products, lots of ready-made, you know, just junk, just a lot of junk. And, anyway, so, you know, we knew something was wrong with that, but we didn't really know what, and we felt like we didn't have any alternatives, you know? And so when we ended up getting invited to this food conference where these crazy ladies were walking around teaching people how to, you know, what it is that we ought to be eating and the evidence behind it. And that is traditional foods, meaning non-factory made foods, foods that you would find on the homestead back in, you know, way back when our ancestors, you know, and it made sense. You eat what is culturally available to you. You're not, you know, necessarily importing everything, but you're, you know, eating what could be grown in your climate and that sort of, you know, that sort of concept. But how it's raised and how it's processed is really key. And, you know, it's not natural to stick a cow in a feedlot and stuff it full of red Skittles that have been rejected. Cows ought to eat grass, and they ought to eat grass in a way that mimics how the buffalo were on the prairie and that sort of thing. Rotational grazing, they're eating fast-growing grasses. They're not standing around in fields of manure, picking up parasites and diseases. They are moving to fresh ground, and they're not returning to that ground for a very long time. And, you know, same with chickens and pigs and, you know, all kinds of livestock. So it just really rocked our worlds. It made sense to us, and we were excited about it because it was like, we can eat butter again. We just need to be careful what kind of butter it is. We can eat bacon. We just need to make sure that it's coming from pigs that are really raised outside, on grass, eating, you know, eating what they were made to eat. And not eating just, you know, whatever scraps the factories are getting rid of that week. So we started looking for those kinds of foods and found, you know, though they were available, and this is back in 2007 when it was kind of a new idea, like the Food Inc. had not come out yet. You know, it just really was not a, you know, this kind of food was not a thing in East Texas. And so we started looking around and found, you know, we were just having to drive like all over the place and make a lot of plans to try to source that food. You know, we'd have to buy like 6 weeks worth of eggs at a time just to make sure we didn't run out. We'd have to buy a whole entire cow because, you know, they didn't want to slaughter half a cow. They only could slaughter one cow at a time. And so, you know, either we had to be able to deal with all that coming into the freezer, or we had to find friends to go in with us to split it. And, you know, but we were very motivated. We were going to find a way to make it work. And so, you know, but not everybody is like that. Not everybody has that drive, or feels that urgency because they haven't had such a severe health crisis yet, which is important. But anyway, so we, you know, in the meantime, Matt was already graduated. I was finishing up my degree, and we were thinking like, what do we want to do? You know, we don't really want to be in the rat race forever. You know, we'd like to do life together. We'd like to invent something in the backyard that we can manufacture and raise our kids. And, you know, and finally it dawned on us, like, why don't we be farmers? We, you know, and I forgot to mention that, you know, Matt had actually started making preparations to go back to school. He went part-time with his engineering job and was taking classes as prerequisites to go to medical school because he wanted to do research on ulcerative colitis and autoimmune disease. And, you know, but we've started to realize like, this is not that complicated. We do not need new drugs. What we really need is real food. And what better way to help people like us than not to go back to school, but to just start farming and start teaching what we had already learned. So that's how the farm dream was born. And, you know, so it's a long story after that. But anyway, we got here to Shady Grove Ranch in Jefferson in 2010 and have been going ever since. So it's been about 9 years.
Well, that's a story. That's an unexpected trip, road journey to get here. So 2007 and 2006 were pretty pivotal years in the sort of, I hate the phrase food movement, but 2006 was Mike Pollan's book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, who introduced me as a reader to Joel Salatin at Polyphase Farm, who probably is the person, I would say, most responsible in a good way for the advocacy of farming in a reasonable and sustainable way. So, and so whether or not you know him, it sounds like you're following the same idea that the cows go eat the grass, chickens follow behind the cows, because it's just this, there's benefits there. And then the chickens turn the cow stuff into stuff that's good for the grass, which turns out to be good for the cows. So this is big, long circle that was there all this time that our grandparents knew about, and somewhere we went way, way off the rails.
Yes, you know, and actually, interestingly, when we were first starting to just learn about this, somebody gave us a copy of the book "You Can Farm" by Joel Salatin, and it's an interesting story. I won't dive into that, but anyway, maybe another time. But you know, it kind of showed us like.
Well,
go ahead. Yeah, sorry.
Well, I'm thinking I've got more than enough here to talk about, so we can probably do a couple more episodes. But and that would be fun, because I think this is something there are a few things to tackle, and one of the reasons that this I think is becoming important is not just to from the food side. So as the food guy, the culinary part of the culinary libertarian, the food guy wants food. I don't want processed stuff. I want food. And I don't even mind, and in fact I do, I make stuff here that I will use store marshmallows to make my own snack bars. Could I make my own marshmallows? I actually have done that. But if I'm going to make snack bars with lots of peanut butter, I'm not gonna make homemade marshmallows just for that. So I'm not opposed to getting an ingredient from the store. I am very much opposed to buying the stuff in the box that has no ingredients I can pronounce, pick, or grow. So I'd rather make that here, and I'm fine with doing. I want to make as much as I can, and as it happens, I can make quite a bit of what I want to have. So the food part is, let's get back to food.
Yeah,
and that does present some issues, which I want to get into in a minute, but also the liberty part. So this isn't necessarily the political pundit side of things, but, and we're going to talk about this in a minute too, when states, Tennessee of note, is high on this, because they're one of their senators, representatives wants to make everybody who is participating in a herd share, who doesn't actually own the herd, make them criminals by drinking raw milk. Well, now this is something that we need to talk about, because they're making criminals of people who want to drink something that's going to make them well, oughtn't make them criminals. And if the possibility exists that that milk can harm them, well, the possibility exists that crossing the street can harm you because you're going to get hit by a bus, or that you're going to twist your ankle on a pine cone. We can't mitigate away risk in all things. That's just idiotic. So then it becomes, what is really the issue? So that's where this becomes the possibility for more than one episode.
Yeah, sure. Well, I guess, where do we want to head next?
Well, let's head here. So I'm not sure if it was an article I read on your blog, but I read an article about arsenic in chicken feed. And I did a little follow-up on that, and it appears that to a good degree that has stopped. So part of me is thinking, okay, it's possible that chickens are being fed apricot seeds, and that would be a natural source of arsenic, but I suspect that's probably not the case. So there's at least two main questions here. And the first one is, how is it that either and or the FDA and the USDA found that putting arsenic in chicken feed is a good idea? And what possible benefit and to whom does arsenic in chicken feed perform?
Yeah, and you know, this is okay. So just to back up just a little bit, you know, you were talking about, you know, just food liberties and all that. You know, a lot of people think like, well, chicken is chicken, you know, and if it says it's natural and, you know, blah, 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 you know, it's probably all right, because buying from a place like Shady Grove Ranch is very inconvenient. It's very expensive. And so I'm just going to buy the, quote, best chicken I can buy from the store. And that's where a lot of people kind of stall out. And so that's why I write blogs about arsenic in chicken and food dyes in the egg, you know, egg production and all the other little issues. You know, it's amazing. I mean, we've been in this business now for over, I'm trying to remember what year we started. I don't know. It's been a long time. I think it's like 11 years. I still learn things about the food system that shock me. And that's bad. That's bad if you're in the industry and you still learn, you know. Anyways, it's scary. But yeah, so the arsenic one, you know, and like you said, you know, there's some evidence to suggest that maybe that practice has halted. But on the other hand, I feel like there's not a real strong evidence to show. And I'll talk about a couple of those things, you know. And I've tried to, I don't want to misrepresent things to people. I don't want to scare them if there's nothing to be scared of. And, you know, I certainly don't want to manipulate anybody into buying, you know, my product or whatever. But what I finally, you know, what I realized in my research was, you know what, we shouldn't have to become experts in this stuff to find out if they're doing this in our food. Like, that's a really bad, you know, that's a bad system that's set up, that everything is hidden. It's so secretive. It's impossible to find out. You know, back like 10 years ago, I remember you used to be able to kind of look it up and like see the process of, you know, here's how they can the vegetable and here's how they seal the can and here's how they, you know, but nowadays it's like, no, we don't really want you to know anything about it. We're just going to, you just trust us. It'll be all right. You know, cause it's below EPA levels. It's below FDA acceptable levels, you know, and so on and so forth. And,
yes, I think that, I'm from the government. I'm here to help.
Yeah, it's bad. But anyway, so to answer your question about the arsenic, okay, so the way that came about was back in the 40s, they started adding arsenic to the chicken feed, but it was an organic form of arsenic. So the argument was that the inorganic form, meaning the non-carbon containing form, or like a more elemental basic form of arsenic is toxic. We know that. We're not going to feed poison to our people. So let's transform it, build it into a carbon-based molecule and feed it to the chickens because the chickens will just poop it out. And based on the science at that time, that was a perfectly acceptable solution. The reason they were doing it is to combat a disease called coccidiosis and another disease called histaminiasis, which infects turkeys and chickens in confinement. And that's a big one, I'll add, in confinement. Okay, so in the 40s, if you can imagine, it's post-World War, that's when real big changes started happening in the food system. People wanted, you know, chicken was kind of a luxury item up until that time. Chicken is not, it's not especially easy to grow it without having, you know, kind of an accelerated program. Most people that ate chicken ate old roosters or old hens that needed to be culled. It was not that often that you ate, you know, a piece of fried chicken that's, you know, tender and can be cooked in less than an hour. Back in the 40s, you know, they started feeding these confinement chickens these things to combat the diseases that were beginning to become a problem for confinement type operations. And like I said, they justified it by, you know, well, the chickens are going to poop it out and it's organic anyway, so it's not going to show up in the tissues. And that continued for what, like 60 years? And so finally, I guess, like, I don't even know who instigated the test. I tried to find out, but I couldn't find it. But for whatever reason, somebody did some tissue tests of chicken and they found, oh my gosh, we were wrong. There actually is arsenic in the tissues and it's not just the organic form. It's actually the inorganic form or the more toxic form. And so they said, okay, well, we're going to, you know, before the FDA really could even do anything about it, the manufacturer of the drug at that time, which I believe was Pfizer, said, okay, well, it's all right. We're just going to go ahead and voluntarily recall it. We're gonna ask you to take away the drug approval for this particular drug. Nitarsin was the one. Because we're going to stop marketing it in the U.S. and Canada. And so the FDA, you know, at that time, I think it was, actually, let me back up. Okay, so yeah, this was back in like 2011 or so. And so the approval was withdrawn. The drug supposedly was removed from the market. But lo and behold, a couple of years later, a consumer petition came forward that was asking, you know, like, we want also these three other drugs that happen to have inorganic, that happen to have organic arsenic in them that is being fed to chickens. These are also out there, and we want these to be removed. And so the FDA kind of did the same thing. It was like, oh, well, it just so happens that the drug company withdrew their application for this drug use in poultry. And so they supposedly withdrew all four drugs, the approval for all four drugs in 2015. And so supposedly by the end of 2015, nobody was marketing the drug in the United States anymore. And, you know, supposedly it wasn't available for use. But the interesting thing about that is it didn't become illegal. It was only not available to be marketed. Like, you couldn't market it in the US. And I don't really know what that means. Like, I don't know if that means they couldn't use it. But if you go to the Merck Veterinary Manual, it's a big giant database of veterinary insight for, you know, for animal care. And as far as I understand, it's a reputable source for like professional, you know, veterinarians. You know, they still have listed in the coccidiosis and histaminiasis treatment. The treatment is use organic arsenic in the feed at such and such a rate. And here's the withdrawal period before slaughter. It's 5 days before slaughter. And so that suggests to me that this is not a done deal, you know. So I did a little bit more research just to satisfy my own curiosity. And, you know, I said, okay, well, so they can't market it in the U.S., but that doesn't mean that we can't get it elsewhere and bring it into the U.S. and use it. If it's not actually illegal to use, then, well, we'll just buy it overseas, import it, and add it to the chicken feed and, you know, no problem. So sure enough, I found two companies in China that do sell Roxarsone, which was one of the major players in the drug, you know, the drug industry. And I told them, you know, I would like a quote for shipping to my U.S. address and, you know, yada, yada. And they got back to me right away, both within 24 hours. It was no problem to ship it into the U.S. There's no, I mean, as far as I know, I didn't take it any farther because obviously I'm not buying arsenic for my chickens. But I was, you know, surprised that nobody said, oh, well, we're not allowed to ship that into the U.S. You know, so I think this is probably a thing. It's hard to say, but, you know, what I really wanted to communicate to people listening is not, you know, be suspicious, I guess, or, you know, or try to get rules that don't allow arsenic in the food system. Because if it's not arsenic, it's something else. You know, there's always going to be something that we're trying to, you know, that's some evil in the food system that, you know, that's trying to break through. And really, you know, I think it's better, like, you shouldn't have to become an expert on what does drug withdrawal mean and what does, you know, like, what are the implications of importing drugs and using them in livestock feeds versus dosing for an actual disease, because there's a difference in the FDA language. There's a difference between like a preventative supplement versus a drug treatment. And anyway, you know, and I just think that like, that's a bad place to be in a food system, you know, and participating in that food system, it just, that's where, how it got where it is, you know, is people, I mean, I'm not, you know, there's no specific person to blame, but the reality is that, you know, if you want cheap food, you're going to have to sacrifice something. And, so often it's the rearing practices, the feeding practices, you know, because there's just only so much cost that you can cut to produce food. And, you know, and unfortunately nowadays, I'm not an economics expert by any means, but, you know, we spend less on our food, like proportion to our income now than ever in history and compared to any other country. And everybody praises that, like, oh, that's such a good thing. You know, our food's so cheap. Now we can spend our money on things that really matter. I'm like, well, wait a second. Food really matters, you know, and why isn't anybody asking the question? And anyway, so I don't know if that makes any sense, but
it does make sense. There is and people who know about these kinds of things will be able to fill in the blank that I'm missing. But as the progression, and so from a libertarian point of view, we would say that as a liberty is taken away, the accommodation of the absence of that liberty just becomes the new status quo. So the bar of toleration just continues to get moved up as more and more things get removed. Or in the case of the food, and this is also sort of whimsically stated, that there is no such thing as a free lunch or a cheap lunch. If you're getting cheap food, well, it's coming at a price. It may not necessarily be a price out of your pocket, but one of the conditions you stated in your explanation about these diseases was that they are particularly prone to birds in overcrowded environments. Well, every one of us has seen pictures of poultry farms where overcrowding would be a luxury compared to how well packed these things are into these, I don't know, quotas, whatever those things are. So it becomes a real complicated problem. If all of the people are going to eat, and they're going to eat food that's affordable, well, there's got to be a way to do it. So one of the, and this is probably for episode 2 or 3, but one of the observations Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez made was that factory farming is a terrible, horrible thing. Okay, well, on some level, I'll accept that there's some truth to the statement. But okay, what does that mean? You have a call to action for, let's return back to, you know, the Laura Ingalls days of everyone is his or her own farmer. Well, now we have a big issue here, because the people in New York and Chicago and San Francisco can't do that. And the people who live where they could do that, well, maybe they don't want to do that. Maybe they don't have the skills to do that. And so just like being a successful farmer, and if you ever watched the show Little House on the Prairie, well, Pa Ingalls had some seasons where the whole crop was destroyed by locusts. Now what do you do? So it isn't an easy, it's a fine political statement to say, well, we all need to take care of our own food and be our own farmers, and the soil sucks, we need to fix the soil. Okay, there's a whole lot of stuff going on in that statement that is being used just for a few hearts on Twitter and some votes and whatever else is going on, but there's some real issues that need to be addressed, and that's not getting it done. So that would be maybe episode 2 or 3, talking about soil and, you know, what if you want to be your own farmer? But let's keep it into this chicken, because you, for the people who live in those metropolitan areas, who have access, just like I do, and probably you too, go to your local grocery and megastore, and you can buy one of those national brand names of chickens or the store brand of chicken, but you're going to pay, and I'm not even sure that this is, if I have faith that the label reads right, which is, well, another show too, the mislabeling of food and the distrust in the labels. If I'm going to buy from a farm like yours or somewhere over in Oregon, and I've been looking, I don't know if there's one here, how does the city dweller obtain food that is, you know, from the know your farmer standpoint, I don't know how that's possible. And maybe that's just one of those unanswerable questions, but that seems like a real issue. If we're talking about beef and lamb and turkey and chicken and everything else, and fish.
Well, the good news is, you know, compared to when we started, the beef farm we got connected with, the first question they asked us is, how did you guys find us? Like, we're not even advertising our beef yet. And it just, you know, we were, like I said, we were very driven. We were, you know, we knew what we were looking for. And somehow we knew we couldn't buy it at the store. I don't know how we knew that back then. But anyway, I would just say, you know, in general, farms like ours are not going to be in big box stores. They're not going to be in supermarkets. And that's just something you've got to reconcile yourself to. The reason we're not in grocery stores is there's two main reasons. It's because, number one, our cheapest price is way higher than theirs. And the reason is not because we're making a killing out here. It's because we know what we want to do with these animals. We want them on clean live vegetation. And that means we've got to figure out shade and water and protection, predator protection. We've got to figure out how to secure them again when we have terrible weather. We've got to secure them when we have floods. And, you know, no matter what our terrain is, we do not have like the perfect, you know, flat, high, you know, hill, hilltop type scenario. We just have to work with what we've got. And so, you know, whereas if you can stick a bunch of chickens in a big building on a concrete slab and just control everything, well, that becomes a lot cheaper. It's a lot cheaper. And so our bottom, you know, our bottom price is just higher. And so, you know, and so a lot of times you can't even get in the door with the supermarket because your price is just so high, even at wholesale. So that's one of the reasons, you know. Now, but I will say, you know, cause a lot of people who hear that and they'd be like, oh no, well, I can't raise my grocery budget at all. So I'm just, you know, I'm up a creek without a paddle. Well, I disagree because number one, you're probably spending more on food already than you really need to, because most people nowadays are eating out several times a week, sometimes several times a day. And, they're also, you know, when you eat CAFO raised product, you're going to tend to eat a lot more than what you would. I mean, it's remarkable. It's a remarkable phenomenon. When you switch to really good quality products, you do not eat as much. And so you do not have to buy as many pounds of chicken. It's not pound for pound exchange. It's actually going to be less from a pasture raised source. And I do a lot of economical type analysis on our products, because this is a number one concern with people. Is they look at our prices, they see our chicken is, you know, 3, 4, 5 times as much as the store-bought chicken. And they think that translates into my grocery bill is going to increase by 3, 4, 5 times as much. But that is absolutely not the case. I fully believe that you can keep your costs to about $2 or $3 per serving for hungry people. That's about what we spend for, you know, all said and done, even if we were buying everything. But the way I accomplish that is, you know, I look for my starches at a certain price point. And, you know, and I've spent the time to identify some sources for my starches and my supplemental ingredients. And we're just not buying a lot of packaged food. Like I make bread and you mentioned a while ago, you know, the store-bought marshmallows, if you want to make energy bars. And that's totally, I totally identify with that. I do not make my own tomato sauce or noodles at this point in my life, but we just don't eat a lot of that stuff. Like if I can't make it in-house, we've kind of just adapted our eating so that we eat what I can make. And so instead of, you know, looking at your food like, oh, well, how am I going to make breakfast cereal? Because that's what we always eat. Well, no, don't think of it like that. Think of what can you make and what would fill your family up? How about scrambled eggs? I mean, scrambled eggs are one of the cheapest, best, most nutritious foods that you can get, even if you're paying $6 or $7 a dozen. How many eggs could you possibly eat? I mean, $6 a dozen, it's 50 cents an egg. Like it's not that much. It's just not that much compared to, you know,
far superior to the.
Yeah. And, you know, and people totally justify like, oh, well, I'm just going to swing through McDonald's and pick up like a $2 breakfast sandwich. Well, there's your eggs. And then there's a hunk of sausage too, because like you totally could have afforded it at that price. But anyway, so back to the, So how does a city person get a hold of this kind of product? Okay, so I have great news. It's you know, it's actually becoming very widely available. But like I said, you cannot find it at the supermarket. Oh, the second big hurdle, that's what I forgot to say. The second big hurdle is just kind of a red tape. Like we've actually pursued it. We've looked at selling to, and we tried to scale our business up a couple years back to try to get into some larger institutions and larger supermarkets. Because our customers were asking for it. They were saying, well, why aren't you in, you know, natural grocers? Why aren't you in Whole Foods? And the red tape to get into a store like that is absolutely absurd. It was going to be a minimum $2,500 a year insurance policy just to sell one product to the store. And we have no guarantee for how much product is going to be sold that way. You know, we don't have a contract. There's nothing protecting the farmer. It's just, you buy the insurance and then come back and talk to us and we'll see if we can get you in. And it would take a whole lot of product to justify an additional $2,500 insurance policy. And that's, you know, and that's not counting the, you know, all the other things that we were told that we would have to do to get into a store like that. So you're just not going to find it in the supermarket, but that is okay because there are many farmers that are coming up with really innovative solutions for how to get product into people's kitchens. And if they're like our farm, they do like routine deliveries to cities where we take product from the farm. You order it online on your own time, whenever you want. You can order it in the middle of the night. You can order it early in the morning, place your order. We'll bring it. We set a time to meet and you just meet us at the spot and we've got all your stuff. It's already bagged up and ready to go. You're in and out in less than a couple of minutes. Some are going even farther than that. They're doing doorstep delivery. If they can make it work as far as finances, because that's quite a bit more expensive, whether they're using third party carrier or just doing it themselves, acting as their own shipping company. There's a lot of farms and they're just dying to reach the people who are looking for their products. And a lot of people just don't even realize they're out there. I would compare it to like, if you can imagine, like the customer who, he knows what he wants. He wants good, real grass-fed beef raised by a real farm, doing it the right way. And, he might be surrounded by like a bunch of bouncer type guys, arm to arm, and behind them is standing the little farmer kind of bouncing up and down, trying to be seen, but he's having to, the farmer's hurdle to get to the customer is, the convenience of the supermarket, the convenience of the ready-made meal box shipped to your door, and those kinds of things. When, one small little step on the buyer's part, on the consumer's part, of just making that connection and committing to picking up that, once a month, once every couple of months, whatever, stocking up, getting a freezer, and just keeping it on hand, it just would make a world of difference for this small farm movement, if people knew that it was out there and they were committed to seeking it out.
Oh, I think that that's absolutely true. I also know that there are situations where the FDA has stopped those kinds of businesses for a variety of reasons, and they always seem to find some sort of precedent. So the Tennessee guy, I think he's using, which is sort of the standard fallback, Wickard versus Filburn, which is a pretty famous case where the guy was growing wheat to feed his cows. It wasn't staying in his backyard, and the Supreme Court decided that that actually was a violation of interstate commerce because if he didn't grow his own wheat, then he would have bought wheat probably from out of state to feed his cows. Therefore, growing wheat in your backyard is a violation by not buying wheat from another state. Well, with that logic, you can't grow your own flowers because you're violating interstate commerce because you would have bought them from the store that came from the other state. So they're keen, they being the thugs, and I'm happy to beat up on the USDA and the FDA. But they make it kind of easy because they go after people who are only trying to sell food and buy food perfectly voluntary. That's as anarchist as it gets. A free market. I want to sell something. I want to buy something. Nice to meet you. And you're both better off for the exchange. And yet they want to shut that down. So that's one of the big frustrations we have. And that's,
yeah,
issue five.
Well, it certainly varies from state to state. I'm happy to report that this particular legislative session in Texas this year has really opened up a lot of doors for small farms, for cottage food producers. It's exciting, and I think people just need to become aware. I mean, the impression that I get, and I'm not on the inside of this, but the impression that I get is, state reps and senators may get 3-4 calls on a particular issue, and so if those 3-4 calls are coming from people who are for, more food freedom, small producers protections, those kinds of things. It doesn't, and people are very intimidated by calling in and making, and making a statement on their, on a particular bill or whatever, but it's really easy. It hardly takes any time at all. And there's tons of really good advocacy groups out there. You know, and so whether you're supporting them financially or just calling when they have action alerts, it's so simple. It's such a simple move. And, you know, we really saw the fruits of that in Texas this year. They expanded cottage foods law all the way into fermented foods and, you know, unlimited baked goods, as long as they're not, you know, principally animal protein. You know, and that's just for safety reasons, which I totally get. I mean, like, you know, not everybody's real careful with how they handle product. And, you know, so the state, I guess, is just trying to take reasonable precaution. But anyway, the point is, you know, it has come a very long way in a short time here in Texas. And, you know, they've been trying to, and it's silly. I know. I mean, I totally disagree with the idea that, like, for instance, raw milk in Texas, you can buy it from the farm as long as the farm's licensed by the state, but you can't, like, the farmer can't ship it to your home. They can't sell it through a grocery store. They can't bring it to a farmer's market. And that's pretty unreasonable because it's like, well, what's the difference? I mean, if anybody knows how to handle milk without spoiling it, it's the farmer. So let them transport it wherever, you know, instead of people driving, you know, across the state with everybody else's milk. You know, anyway, so it's coming along. There are some ridiculous rules out there for sure. But you know, I think it starts with, you know, just people being aware and supporting those farmers, even despite the hurdles. And in the meantime, working to, you know, to change things so that it becomes easier for us farmers. Another one of the ones that passed this year in Texas was a cap on farmers market fees, because if you want to go set up at three different markets, you're going to have to pay the market fee over and over and over just to be a member of every single one. Well, they capped it because there were advocates saying, no, this is ridiculous. We've already paid the fees. Let us just operate, you know, at any farmer's market in Texas. And, you know, and so trying to relieve some of those hurdles that farmers have.
Well, that was good. Yeah, that's mostly, it seems like Abbott's doing pretty good. So,
yeah, you know, and I know some states, you know, we always make fun of, like, Nevada, where prostitution is legal, but raw milk is not. Like, this is good, you know, well, obviously.
Conceivably, you could get the raw milk, just not from the bovine source.
Oh, man, it's bad. Yeah, but...
That's another... Yeah, never mind. That's that might be a bit much for a family show.
Yeah. Well, and you know, I mean, maybe it's too myopic or whatever, but, you know, I just feel like, you know... While we're waiting for, you know, better laws and you know, more freedoms, you know, by all means, support those farmers, because, you know, just in our brief time here in East Texas, like I said, we've been in operation. We actually started with a raw milk program, believe it or not. But anyway, we don't do it anymore because it's too labor intensive. But we started in 2008, and you know, so it's been 11 years. And in that 11 years, we've probably seen at least a dozen farms start and fail, you know, and some of them went out with a blaze. I mean, it was bad. It was painful. It was expensive. It was bad. And those people are certainly not farming anymore because they had such a terrible experience with different things, you know, but some, you know, it just slow and steady wins the race, you know. We want committed customers that are looking, that love our products, that, you know, want to help us improve, that aren't going to get steamed if they have one little bad experience, you know, but that are going to come and talk to us. You know, they're going to ask questions about how to cook it, and they're going to, you know, if we run out of bacon, they're going to keep buying because they know, you know, we still have pigs to feed while we're waiting to process more bacon.
Bye.
So, yeah.
Cool. Well, I'm looking at the clock, and I know we both have things we need to do, but I want to get this last little part. That was the part that you said you were nervous about, but this is the easy part. If you've ever seen the TV show Inside the Actor's Studio, at the end, he asks some fun questions. And so this is my fun question portion of the show. Oh. Of the five flavors, sweet, salty, bitter, sour, and umami, which one do you enjoy the most?
Ooh. Well... I like sour.
What's your favorite food?
Chocolate. I mean, like real food, like meal?
Oh, it doesn't matter. What's your least favorite food?
Least favorite? You know, being a farmer, I'm just not that picky anymore. Goodness. I'm trying to think of something I don't like. I don't know. Chevy, what's my least favorite food? Ask my son. He says ragweed tea. We tried to make an allergy tincture, and it turned out disgusting. So is that a valid answer?
Okay, well, there's a valid answer. What gets you excited?
I guess it gets me excited when people start to know that there are farms like ours out here.
What turns you off?
Complaining without providing solutions.
What sound do you love?
I love piano.
What sound do you hate?
Fingernails on a chalkboard.
A fairly common answer. And what is your favorite food indulgence?
Can I answer twice? Chocolate?
Sure. No, that's perfect. That works for me. Chocolate's an excellent answer for pretty much all those except least favorite. All right. So thank you very much for your time. I know we got to get running here. Where can people find your website and how can they keep up with your blog?
Yeah. So our website is shadygroveranch.com. From there, you can hop on our newsletter. That's how I usually send out blogs and that sort of thing. We only sell locally, but we enjoy hearing from people from out of state. We have a lot of out of state followers on our newsletter and everything. And I'm trying to make our website a little more mobile friendly, but anyway, I'm busy farming also. So,
it's a good job for the kids.
Yeah, right.
Put that homeschooling to work. Start your own business. Right,
that's
kids?
Right. Yep.
Well, Jerrica, I appreciate your time today and all of the challenges we had with technology today, which if everything goes well, no one will know anything about. So everyone will say, what are you talking about? So definitely, I'm serious about doing another follow-up because there's just lots more information I think is worth getting out. And if you're keen for it, we can work on diving into more.
Yeah, sure. Sounds good.
Excellent. Well, fabulous. Well, again, thank you so much for your time today.
Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
All right, folks, that's going to do it. You can find a link to Shady Grove Ranch on the show notes page, culinarylibertarian.com/41, as well as links to the affiliates mentioned. You heard me mention AOC. While she is not currently running for president, there are many who are and are, well, ill-informed, let's be kind, about the basics of economics and logic. Well, that's pretty nice, I suppose. They will do little to remedy that in themselves. You can lay waste to the arguments at the work water cooler with a firm grasp of both logic and economics with courses at Liberty Classroom. Use my affiliate link, culinarylibertarian.com/biteback, to bite back against the fractured thinking coming out of Washington. That's culinarylibertarian.com/biteback. Have a good week, and I'll see you soon. Music for the Culinary Libertarian podcast is provided by Matthew Bankert at mattbankert.com.